Thinking about joining us in Indianapolis for the Gospel Coalition's 2024 Women's Conference? The regular rate price of $239 goes up to $259 on May 8th. This is your final chance to save on your registration. Join us June 20th through the 22nd to feast together on the words of Jesus with keynote messages from Jen Wilkin, Melissa Kruger, David Platt, and more, and featuring worship music led by Shane and Shane. Sign up before the price increases on May 8th at tgcw24.org.
So it's not just about having Logos 7 Bible software all tricked out on your desktop. If you're going to succeed in finding the jewels of God's revealed truth, it's a personal interaction with Him. It's an excavation. It is a looking where most people aren't looking. It's a being willing to go down deep into the shaft of divine reality and find things by spending time excavating and looking and searching, but not just with tools, but in a state of faith and in expectation that God is going to show you things if you spend the time.
Welcome to Help Me Teach the Bible. I'm Nancy Guthrie. Help Me Teach the Bible is a production of the Gospel Coalition, sponsored by Crossway, a not-for-profit publisher of the ESV Bible, Christian books and tracts. Learn more at crossway.org. Today, I'm in Minneapolis in the offices of Desiring God. I imagine that some of you who are listening, you would love to be with me because, like me, Desiring God, the many aspects of all that they create and produce has been helpful to you, like it has been to me. I'm here today talking to Tony Reinke, a name that you probably recognize, especially if you listen to the Ask Pastor John podcast, which Tony hosts along with Pastor John for Desiring God. This is my first interview to do for Help Me Teach the Bible with someone who doesn't call himself a Bible teacher. And yet I think that what Tony has written about and what he has to share with us today, I think you're going to find has a lot of implications for us as Bible teachers. So Tony, thank you for being willing to help us teach the Bible.
Well, thanks for stopping into the office. I appreciate you stopping by.
You bet. Now I notice you also, you have a lot of jobs, but one of the things you do that I want to talk about a little bit first off is this is fascinating to me. You manage a tribute website to your favorite Dutch theologian.
Oh, no.
Herman Bovink. I think that's incredible. Yep. So tell me how that came about and explain some of our listeners that might not be a name that they're familiar with. So who is it and what is it about his theology that's so compelling you as a busy dad of, what is it, three kids. And you're writing and then at Desiring God that you want to host this website. Tell us.
Well, especially as a Baptist. So he's a Presbyterian Dutch theologian, right? Like, yeah. So there's some disagreement, of course. But when it comes to systematic theology, I haven't found anybody that does it as well as Herman Bovink. And John Bolt and the team at Baker Academic published his, translated and published his 4-volume Dogmatics, which was a huge accomplishment. In 2008, it was my book of the year, along with ESV Study Bible. So it was like Bovink and ESV Study Bible had to split the award for me personally for my 2008 book of the year. It was an amazing achievement, and Bovink is so good, so insightful, so biblical. But what he does as a systematician is he then branches out into social topics. He looks at education. He looks at poverty. He looks at ecumenical issues. He looks at just a broad array of social issues and addresses them biblically. And the way he does it is so compelling. So I was like, I want to create a website to introduce him to other people.
So what kind of things do you have on that website?
Well, I've got as many of his English works that are in the public domain are on there for free. There's an entire index of all these works that have been translated.
So tell me this. Like, I'm right now working on a project where I've been doing a lot of research on the Covenant of Works. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people refer to Bovink's writings on that. So could I go to your site and search in some of his works for what he's written about the Covenant of Works?
No, unfortunately, because a lot of his more recent English translated works are in the in copyright,
okay,
Baker and stuff. So there's links to those books, but you wouldn't be able to search them all, okay, Unfortunately. But there's a lot of books about Bovink that you can find there. And so it's not necessarily a collection like Desiring God. It's a collection of a lot of free stuff. It's more of a collection of like, here's how you can get to the works. Yeah. But he's worth every penny.
So what's the most important insight you think you gleaned from your study of Hermann Bach?
Oh, boy. Grace restores nature. Grace restores nature. This idea that nature and grace are not opposites, but that grace is restoring nature, putting things back together again until the day in which Christ returns and we see all things brought together and restored, Revelation 3:14, I think it is. And so he's seeing that already, is that there's not an opposition between the gospel and nature, but there's a cohesion. They work together, that the gospel is coming in to do away with sin. Sin has corrupted creation. And so the gospel comes in and takes that sin and is chipping it away from what God created. So grace restores nature. That, I think, is the most profound insight that he has to offer.
That is profound.
And it's just so, it's rich throughout his works, and it's so valuable, so important to understand, so that we don't have this this grace against nature perspective that's just not healthy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, so I think the first book you wrote that I was really aware of is your book that's called Lit, A Christian Guide to Reading Books. So you're kind of the guru for reading, and of course, people who listen to this podcast who are teaching the Bible are generally readers.
Yeah.
So, speak to us a second as Bible teachers. What's your best advice for Bible teachers about how we choose what we read?
You do have to be incredibly selective. You are probably going to have to base your reading on what you're going to teach. So if you're going to teach the book of Genesis, you want to get three or four commentaries and go deep in Genesis. If you're going to teach on womanhood or masculinity, you want to go deep in those issues and find the four or five best books that you can find and then give yourself time.
How are we
going to
decide
those?
What are the best books before we spend all of our budget and then we get one that was like, that's not what we wanted?
Yeah, so your pastor is going to have some really good recommendations. When I was a new believer, I went to my pastor all the time, said, I need book recommendations. And he just essentially gave me all the books that he read in seminary. And I just started walking through them.
He gave you his library or he just gave you access?
Yeah, to borrow.
Okay.
So I went back and some of the books that I bought and kept in my own personal library. But pastors usually have really good recommendations. You can track with the Gospel Coalition, Themelios. But going online, finding people in the field and just asking them questions. I mean, I always send questions to Bible scholars that I probably shouldn't have access to, but I do. And so I'm like, I'm studying this topic. What would you recommend? You know, and just give me three books, you know. And so I'm always doing that. And people are really helpful. If you find the right person in the right field, they'll have all sorts of suggestions for you. So
Great idea. That's how
I go about it.
Another one of your books is Newton on the Christian Life in Crossway's series on a number of key persons. What else is there? There's Calvin on the Christian life and
Bonhoeffer, Luther, Augustine.
So why did they tap you to write the one on Newton?
They couldn't find anybody.
No.
That's exactly what it is. Well, first of all, Newton's not really a theologian, so they're already stretching it there.
Okay.
Number two, there's really, there aren't many scholars who study Newton. Newton is a fairly down-to-earth pastor who's just trying to help simple people get through life in a way that honors God. I mean, he's not Calvin. He's not in an ivory tower writing like Bavinck did. He's writing spiritual letters. So his legacy is really about 1,200 letters that he wrote and sent off to people, and that's it. And it doesn't attract a lot of scholarly attention. So I got tapped because they couldn't find anybody. I'm sure they couldn't find anybody else. That's why. But I happened to live in the D.C. area at the time, so I was able to go to the Library of Congress and spend a lot of time in the rare book.
I was going
to
say, how do you research a book like that?
It was fun. It was so much fun. I got so geeky and nerdy and spent weeks at the Library of Congress and just finding as many old books as I could find. And it was one of the funnest parts of my career ever, is spending that month or so at the Library of Congress, finding those old published letters.
So give us one nugget from Newton as Bible teachers that would help us in our pursuits.
I think the most profound thing that stays with me is how many suffering people wrote him letters. And they knew that he suffered. They knew that his story included suffering. And they knew that his life was full of pain. I mean, everyone's life at that time was full of pain, but his in particular. And so he would get lots of letters from people who said, hey, you know, I just lost my son. What would you say to me? I just lost my wife. What would you say to me? I'm about to lose my husband. What would you say to me? And the thing that he tells people over and over again is, and it's so moving, this idea that if Jesus went to the cross for you and bore the wrath of God on your behalf, then no pinch of pain you will ever experience is apart from God's sovereign design. And so if Jesus bore the wrath, that means that any pain we endure is not coming because God couldn't stop it. He put it into your life for a good reason, ultimately. And he shows that in the cross, in that Christ bore our wrath. So if the hands that were nailed to the tree for us would allow the suffering to us, it's not because he couldn't stop it, because he bore the wrath. And so that, I think, he would repeat that over and over to people, that the cross really shows us that everything we're not intended to experience, Jesus absorbed on the cross. That's moving. I mean, the first time I saw that, I broke down in tears. I mean, it's just so, so moving. And he does that just over and over again, just looking at Christ and looking at the cross and interpreting life in light of Jesus. So,
yeah, that that teaching on God's sovereignty in suffering, mark really of desiring God as well. And I know that in the interactions that I have with grieving parents, you know, we host a retreat for couples who have lost children, and on those weekends when all these couples come together, it all pivots on that, on that one issue.
Wow,
was this somehow apart from God that he allowed this somehow, or was he in it? I mean, just those questions about God's sovereignty become very personal rather than just theological in the midst of loss.
Another thing he would do is he would use the metaphor of the burning bush, and he would apply that to people who suffer inordinately. And what he would build out is this idea that those who suffer especially harshly in this life, who don't lose the faith, who keep the faith, they are like a bush burning. So that we see them and we're like, what is it that sustains that person through all this? And they're given this unique opportunity to glorify God in their faith. So it's a spectacle unconsumed is kind of the phrase he uses, which I use in the book, which Johnny Erickson Tada read and then took and titled her new devotional with it. So, I mean, that just shows you how powerful Newton's little phrases can become when it comes to suffering.
All right, but you have a brand new book.
Yes.
That I really came to talk to you about today. And as I told you before in our conversation, there was just so many sentences in this book that stood out to me on a topic that I initially kind of wondered, really, a whole book about this? Maybe a blog post? But there is so much here that I'm personally finding really helpful. So the book I'm talking about is your new book called 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You. I don't think anybody who has a phone attached to the hip, anyone who has had that sense of leaving the house and getting far enough away from the house that you can't go back and realizing that either you left your phone at home or you have no power. No person who's ever experienced that would argue with the fact we have become very tied to, very dependent on our phones. And, you know, even anywhere we go, we look around and everybody's looking at their phone. Our kids are given phones earlier and earlier. So what I wanted to talk to you about specifically, Tony, for Help Me Teach the Bible, is how does our love, our commitment to, maybe even worship of, is that too far, of our phones in our hands, how does that impact our preparation for teaching, our presentation of teaching? And then we'll move into talking to what the implications are for what you've written here for those we are teaching. So maybe we say, okay, I'm phone free. I'm not affected by technology, but I would challenge you on that. But those you're teaching certainly are, and that's probably going to impact. So why don't you just tell us first, what were you trying to do with the book?
You know, there's a lot of studies now that talk about the way we use our phones are causing eye strain and neck strain and obesity and lack of, we don't take as deep of breaths. our heart rates slow down inordinately. There's all sorts of physiological, psychological effects on our phones. And what I wanted to do is press through all those studies and say, okay, well, what is it that draws us to our phone to begin with? What are the desires? What is it that lures us over and over again, that the approval that we want, the way that we can, you know, take a photograph and publish it and get responses to it immediately, which is something that's so unique to our generation. We've never seen that before. But I think one of the things that stood out to me in the book is realizing that when it comes to distractions, the smartphone is unique. The digital age is unique. But there's something that's pretty universal about facing distractions, and it goes back to the parable of the four soils that Jesus talks about. Bible teachers are sowers. So we're just throwing seed everywhere. You know, all the soils, we're just throwing seed. And some of that seed is going to fall on rocky soil. Some of that seed is going to grow up with thorns and thistles around it. And what Jesus talks about is the desire for wealth, the desire for material possessions is going to choke out the word. And so when you go back and you look at Mark chapter 4, I think one of the things that we see in that text is that Bible teachers have always faced distractions in gospel ministry. There have always been thorns, there's always been thistles choking out what we're trying to sow. So I think the first thing we have to do is acknowledge that this is not totally unique. The second thing we have to realize is that we do have to come face to face with the desires in our own hearts that are luring us to our phones over and over for approval, for platform building, for fame, for self-glory. It's all of these little things. There's 12 different areas that I identify in the book, but they're all just, they're there in our hearts. And it's not that the phone put them in our hearts. It's that sin in our hearts causes us to reach for our phone for those 12 areas of gratification or self-fulfillment or whatever it is. It's just it's a battle. It's a constant battle.
So somebody might be listening at this point, begin to think, okay, Tony Reinke is Mr. Anti-Technology, Mr. Anti-Phone. He probably doesn't even own a phone. But you said in the book you were one of the earliest adopters, right?
Yeah. Oh, I'm an early adopter to every kind of technology that you can imagine. And I'm an addict to my phone. I'm an addict to digital technology. My wife knows it. She encouraged me to write this book because as I say in a letter that I sent out with the book, like, this is part therapy for me. This is not me preaching at you, it's me preaching at me. So you're listening into me preaching against, you know, to myself. And especially in the conclusion, I really show, like, okay, I've written this book, now I've got to apply it into my life. And it's not as though I'm writing this out of application of what I'm already doing. I'm writing this out of what I hope my life will become. As a better father, better husband, better worker, better, you know, this is really my aspiration. It's not where I haven't arrived.
Well, you say early on, if you own a smartphone, you've likely abused it. So maybe you need to help us understand what's proper use and what's abuse. Is that a clear line?
Yeah, it's going to be different for different people. And it goes back to calling. And this is really one of the things I'm trying to push in, especially in the first chapter, is, you know, our world is talking about what is a distraction and are we being distracted to death? And my question back, and the thing that I think we as Christians can offer back as an even deeper question, is the question of what is the undistracted life? What does it mean to live undistractedly? And I mean, we wouldn't have time to go into all the detail, but 1 Corinthians 7 is Paul's chapter length attempt at explaining what the undistracted life is. It's the marriage and singleness chapter, which is why it gets a little bit complicated, because you've got to walk through that dicey situation. But when you come out the end of 1 Corinthians 7, you see that Paul has very clear categories of distraction and undistraction. And it comes down to life purpose. It comes down to a life of faith. It comes down to what I would call an eschatological urgency, that Christ is coming back. I mean, the fact that he's coming back, like, has to be on our minds and drives what we do day in and day out. It drives the decision to marry or to remain single. It drives the decision to what do I do with my smartphone? Where do I work? What are my priorities for this day? They have to be driven in light of Christ's return. But it comes down to vocation. What has God called me to do? And how does my phone help me in that? And how does my phone get in the way of that?
Well, you really got me in this chapter, asking the question where you say we are addicted to distraction, and you list a number of things. And you said, first, we use digital distractions to keep work away, that Facebook is a way of escape from our vocational pressure. And I guess this brings up why I really wanted to talk to you, because You know, I've been writing and preparing to teach a long time, but I have sensed a shift in myself, which I think is attributable not just to my phone, but mm-hmm. Facebook on my desktop as well, yeah. and other social media, and the fact that my phone's also dinging with texts
right.
from my friends, and then people I don't even know, you know, send me a letter via Messenger on Facebook or whatever. And so there's that aspect of distraction, but that's external. Mm-hmm. What troubles me even more is the internal sense that I feel that when I'm working away on something and something gets really hard for me to figure out how I'm going to explain, I just can't seem to find the words or the ideas, and it gets really hard. Well, that's when I go to Facebook, you know, or that's
right.
when I distract myself. That's just always easier than thinking hard and sticking with it and persevering with the thought. And so it seems to me that this has significant import to those of us who need to be able to think deeply for long periods of time to prepare to communicate the word.
Totally. You, reading and thinking are such unique arts. Like, it's not really science. It's like an art. Like, how does your brain actually think, and how do you read, you know, black symbols on a piece of white paper, and then they're sounds, but then they're words, they're concepts, they're moving images that, you know, get enacted into our brains. Like, it's literacy is such a fascinating thing. And when I started reading books back in 2009, 2010 to write my book on literacy, it was just striking to me how deep you can go and like, what does it mean to read? You know, it's a mystery. It's a gift. And we don't really have a lot of studies to know, like, okay, what has happened to literacy with the incline in hyperpalatable digital distractions? You know, these things that just lure us back time and time again. We don't know exactly what's happening. What we have are stories. And even in 2009, 2010, you started to hear more and more stories of, like, David Ulin, U-L-I-N is his name. He was the books editor at the New York Times. Or the LA Times, I'm sorry, I can't remember which of the two. Anyhow, he professionally was a book reader. That's what he did for a job, is he read books and he reviewed books. And he said by 2009 that he could no longer read the books that he enjoyed 10 years earlier. So he could look at his shelves and see all the novels that he had enjoyed reading 10 years earlier, and he said, there's no way I could read through even one of those books and enjoy it like I did 10 years ago. And so we're starting to hear stories like that. There's an even more popular story, more famous story, and that is from a guy named Nicholas Carr, who is a journalist. He wrote the big viral hit online, Is Google Making Us Stupid?, which is an article that went crazy in 2008, which led to his book, The Shallows. But his article was really huge, and it brought up these questions of, like, what happens to us when we look back on our lives and we see the shelf of books that we used to enjoy reading and we can't do it anymore? We have story after story telling us that our literacy is in decline, in sharp decline, and that poses serious issues for the church. I mean, we've got to be people of the word. We've got to be strong in literacy. The Bible is probably the longest and the oldest and the most complex book that we will ever try to read, and certainly the people we're teaching. I mean, we're asking them to read a book that's way longer, way older, and way more complex than anything they're ever going to try to read on their own. And so there's no simple, easy solution. Other than just blocking out huge bits of time to go in and read and study and strengthen the muscle that we have of literacy and to block out those distractions. And we just have to – that's a discipline that we just have to get back to.
So it's not hopeless? I mean, is my brain irrevocably changed?
Oh, man. I hope not, but I don't think we have a certain answer to that question. I think we just have to keep pushing against – we have to be a people that are we're resisting the sort of the marketers who want every little gap of our day filled up with digital entertainment, digital jokes, digital memes. We have to keep pushing against that for a number of reasons, but one is to protect our literacy. But it can be done. I mean, we can preserve our literacy by preserving 60 minutes a day. If we can preserve 60 minutes a day to read, that's 420 minutes a week. I mean, we can read 50 plus books a year.
Quick blog posts that I'm scrolling through, does that count?
It depends on how you read them, quote unquote, because if you're just skimming them for the subtitles, that's not necessarily going to help build literacy. You have to find a way to slow down and focus your mind on what you're reading. And for me, that only happens with either printed out blog posts in a pen or a printed book in a pen. So I use electronic books to search. I definitely use electronic books to read it for what purpose? Yeah, for comprehension. I linger over the text. There's something, the way that we've been wired is to think that digital text should be skimmed and printed text should be read more slowly. Study after study after study has proven that to be the case. People just naturally read too fast on digital text. Now, maybe eventually in the future, like the next generation can teach themselves to slow down and read digital text more slowly, but we have to linger on texts, and that just doesn't happen in the digital world, especially the way the web is created, because we're made to want to jump from link to link to link, because that's how marketers make money, that's how page views are generated, that's how everybody wins on the internet, is to get us to click and to bounce and to jump and to constantly be moving.
You had a statistic in the book. I can't remember exactly. I want to say that you said the average person spends 53 minutes a day on like the various Facebook iterations.
That's just
Do I
Facebook.
Have that correct?
Yeah, Facebook and Instagram, 50
so
minutes a day.
So the average person spends, am I right about the number, 53? Mm-hmm. 53 minutes a day on just various aspects of Facebook.
Yeah.
All right. So we talked about the challenge in regarding concentration because of distractions for the Bible teacher. But this seems to hit on another challenge to Bible teachers. And that is, I mean, if we're going to teach the Bible, it just takes a lot of time.
It does.
It takes a lot of time to study, to read, mm-hmm. and prepare. And so part of that, part of our connection to this online world is also just the amount of our time mm-hmm. it absorbs.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Job 28 is the passage that I go to. It's a beautiful chapter. I love it. It's worth, we won't have time to read the whole thing, but you should just read out loud Job 28. It's beautiful literature. But what Job is wrestling with there is how do we find divine wisdom? And he's contrasting it with human innovation and technology of the day, which was excavation. Okay? So he's talking about, like, he's got this, I love this image of, like, man can go down into the dark shafts and look for gold and diamonds and all these precious jewels. And he's got this image of like a guy on the end of a rope being let down, and he's swinging on the end of a rope going down into the shaft to find diamonds and gold and stuff. And like that is human innovation and technology in Job's day. Is he even uses the phrase that we can, in his day, we could flip mountains upside down and look for gold underneath the mountain. You know, amazing technology. And so he asks, well, is searching for divine wisdom like that? And he comes to the conclusion that no, it's actually harder than that. It is an excavation. But what makes it more difficult is that divine wisdom is a gift from God. And so our studies, to be fruitful, have to be done in the fear of God for the purpose of holiness before God. So it's not just about having Logos 7 Bible software all tricked out on your desktop. Like, it's if you're going to succeed in finding the jewels of God's revealed truth, it's a personal interaction with Him. It's an excavation. It is a looking where most people aren't looking. It's a being willing to go down deep into the shaft of divine reality and find things by spending time excavating and looking and searching. And, you know, Pastor John obviously emphasizes this a lot with Agassiz's fish and looking at the fish, looking at the fish. We have a new video out online. Just, you know, just keep looking at the text, looking at the text, looking at the text, but not just with tools, but in a state of faith and in expectation that God is going to show you things if you spend the time and you're motivated by the right reasons, which is to glorify Him and to fear Him and to love Him and to treasure Him. So what Job 28 does, and it's really fascinating to see, is that you have human ingenuity on one hand of excavating the earth for all these jewels, and you see that actually searching for divine wisdom is actually even more subtle, more difficult than that, because it's something that's done in personal relationship with God. And so again, having Logos 7, having tools is really good. It's really important. But God is not going to bless you with divine wisdom just because you have all the right tools. I think that's the takeaway from that chapter in Job, is that it has to be done in a spirit of dependency, has to be done in a spirit of faith. And it's like the treasure in the field. It's like the kingdom. It's like the gospel. Like, you know that it's buried in that field. And so you spend everything that you have to get this field and to go and excavate the treasure of who Christ is. Proverbs 1 through 3, Proverbs 1, 2, and 3, especially chapter 3, talks about this. Like, Bible study is not going to be easy. It's going to be hard because it's excavating for divine truth. And it's just something that takes a lot of work, takes a lot of faith. And you have to, when you find the treasure, you have to know what to do with that treasure. And that is to respond in faith and in trust and to treasure God who gave it. So it's even more complicated than just doing scholarship, because there's a human relationship involved with God.
You talked about spending everything you have to own it. You know, a lot of our capital is tied up in time.
Yeah.
Right. And so I always find it interesting in our day. I mean, we can say the things we don't get around to, we sometimes use the excuse, I didn't have time for it. And I've just tried to excise that from my vocabulary to force myself to say, I didn't make time for it.
Yeah.
Because in our modern culture, we pretty much, most of us, can do what we
have the time.
Want to do.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
We have washing machines, yeah. and we go to the grocery store and pick up all of our food. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so usually what that means for us, at least in our modern Western world, is we make an investment on what we love.
That's right.
Right. And so 53 minutes a day on Facebook says that's what I love.
Yeah.
And 53 minutes perhaps spent instead in God's words, even listen to him, says that's what I love. So I find that very convicting. If that is an echo, a reflection of my love for Christ, that's challenging.
Yeah. The thing about digital technology is it's trying to fill in the little gaps of our lives with new content. So it's not just a bunch of TV networks trying to vie for your primetime television audiences, you know, between 7 and 10 or whatever it is. It's about media companies vying for the 10-second gaps in your day. So when Spurgeon talked about, you know, between the things that I do in my day, I like to offer up a little prayer in between things. Well, what we like to do is offer up a tweet in between things. And so we've got 30 seconds of time between what I'm doing now and my transition into the next thing that I want to do, and we fill it up with social media. Mm-hmm. Spurgeon was filling that up with prayer. And so what media companies are doing now is they're trying to squeeze every single second that they can in the cracks of our lives. And that's what's unique about digital media. This is not 7 to 10 p.m. Thursday night, you know, watch NBC or whatever it is. This is like we're talking about every tiny little gap of your attention from the moment you wake up to the moment in which you fall asleep. And then if you can't fall asleep and you just check your phone at midnight and 1 and 2 a.m. and you're like sleep is the ultimate nemesis to the screen. And so marketers are like, how do we keep expanding people's awake time? My wife and I saw this commercial the other day. It was Hulu, the online streaming company, teamed up with Visine. So it's a Visine Hulu commercial about this guy who is spending too much time watching TV that his eyes hurt. And so he's using Visine so he can get more screen time into his day. And we looked at each other and we were like, this is what our world is coming to. It's like squeezing every moment that we possibly have for more screen time. And the things that are offered up are hyper palatable. They are like Twinkies. They are like sugar. They are dopamine hits. They are things that we want and we want to come back to time and time again because we find them, even though not ultimately satisfying for the moment, it is like a piece of candy. It's like a cookie. It's a little hit. And so it's hard to resist.
Well, when you mentioned in there from first thing in the morning till night, you kind of hit on why I really didn't want to read your book because I knew you were going to convince me that I shouldn't start my day scrolling on my screen. So go ahead, give it to me. Why should I not do that?
Okay, I'll tell you why we both should not do that.
Okay.
The reason why is because when we wake up in the morning, we're trying to orient our entire day, our priorities, our thought life, our hearts, all of it has to be recalibrated from the moment we wake up. There are mercies new every morning. And as Pastor John says, Satan wakes us up every morning and he's sitting on our face, you know, like the temptations are right there. And so we have to get into God's word. We have to pray. We have to get our hearts right for the day. And if we begin our day by scrolling through Facebook, scrolling through Twitter, what we're doing is we're looking for personal affirmation. We're looking for people. What have people said about us? We're looking for what is new and weird and curious and crazy and newsworthy. Like we want to be, you know, we always want to be in the know. And so we're drawn back to our phones for so many different reasons. You mentioned earlier that we want to just put off hard things. Like if there's a busy day coming up, or you got to deal with someone you don't want to deal with, or the pile of laundry is twice as high as it's ever been, or like, you know, it's just like you just want to stay in bed and just yeah. But I think one of the things, there's so many things that C.S. Lewis taught us, especially in the Screwtape Letters. And one of the things that he, and I in the book with this, he talks about the nothing strategy of Satan, this idea that what Satan wants us to do is to focus on things that are not satisfying to our souls and not essential to our vocations. That's the sweet spot. Things that are not ultimately satisfying to us and don't make us better people or help us in our vocation. So it's the nothing strategy. It's the dreary flickering. That's the phrase that Lewis actually used, the dreary flickering of amusements. And if Satan can get us stuck there, then we won't be satisfied. Our souls will not be happier. And we won't be better people. We won't be better neighbors. We won't be better children of God. And so we get stuck in this nothing, this place of nothingness. Our lives are just full of nothing. And that's what I've found just over the years in social media. Like, I fill my life with so much nothing that it doesn't make me happier. It doesn't satisfy me. It doesn't give me rest. It doesn't give me joy or happiness in the end. It's just another sugar hit that I'm going to have to come down from, unless I go seeking for another sugar hit. And this affirmation just keeps luring us back because we need a new hit every day. Someone tell me that I matter, that I'm worthwhile. And so instead of trying to find our approval before God and in Christ, we try to find it before our friends and social media. And it just doesn't satisfy us. It never will, and it never has.
Well, we've been pretty hard on social media. There are, at least I think, some good aspects to social media for the typical Bible teacher.
Absolutely.
I mean, one that comes to mind to me is we want to know the people we're teaching. We want to love the people we're teaching. And to be able to kind of track things that are going on in their lives, to know what's important to them, that I think at times can help us not only understand their worlds, love them, and be able to have better conversation with them in the short time that we see them, but that can really help us with our applications and with even shaping our teaching, don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I've had some conversations with pastors of late who really enjoy Facebook for that very, very reason. They get to know their people in their congregation in a way that doesn't obligate them in a lot of ways to I don't know how to exactly explain it, but it's sort of like a one-way mirror where you can see what's happening in people's lives, and there's a voyeuristic weird thing to that. But if you use it rightly, you can get a sense of what's happening in the lives of your people, which wasn't the case 20 years ago. I mean, I remember talking with older pastors who were like, you know, you had to do home catechism, or you had to go over and you had to spend time, and that's wonderful. You should always be spending time with people in your church, but there's a way to do that now with Facebook that just allows you to be human as a pastor, as a Bible teacher. You can talk about your favorite sports teams. You know, you can really express things that you wouldn't do in a Bible teaching setting that humanizes, especially in pastoral ministry, I think is really helpful. So there's a lot of wonderful, wonderful ways and opportunities to use social media in a way that's positive, that's beneficial, that's not always preaching, that's not always trying to make a biblical point, but it's just humanizing you as a person. And that can be done really powerfully. I think Ray Orland does that really well. A lot of like gospel grace in there, but you definitely get a sense of his heart and his home and his new dog and his relationship with Janny and his kids. And like, he does it really well. That sort of like behind the scenes, but also offering grace and speaking on social things. And then,
but so often really I just feel like I get to peek in on his devotions because it's a line from scripture. And then he adds a second line that just adds light, illumines that,
absolutely.
Which is beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. There is no substitute for social media and the way that we can, I mean, to have access to 300 Facebook friends is access that no one in human history has had that kind of access in just everyday average. Yeah. You can reach 200 or 300 friends on Facebook with a birth announcement, with a wedding announcement. You'll get 100 likes and 100 years ago, you couldn't reach that many people in one day. You know, you could reach 5 people if you stood on your barn and yelled as loud as you could. And now we can reach, you know, 200 or 300 people. That's the average number of Facebook friends for someone on Facebook. 200 or 300 people to reach in a single day. That's unprecedented. We have reach that's never been experienced before.
Hopefully it works both ways, too, that our people have a sense that they know us, not just the upfront teacher but that they know us in a more authentic way. Although you might challenge that, because I know you wrote a lot in your book about how there's a false authenticity.
There is.
Oftentimes in social media that we have to fight, constantly be at war against, don't we?
There's a professionalization that's happened in social media, and that is that I know everything that I post on Twitter, John Piper's going to read it and see it, you know, because I work at DG. You know, so like there's going to be things that I'm just not going to post. Either it's too funny, it's too maybe risque. It's like, I don't know. I'm going to be very hesitant to post that. Well, you think of a student who is in high school and wants to apply to Harvard or Cambridge or you name it. Like everything they post on social media is probably going to be searched. Someone's going to go through it and admissions. And so you are trying to put forward that you're confident, that you have it together. You're not necessarily intentionally trying to make yourself look perfect, although I think that motivates some people. I think a lot of it is just like the professional world is going to look at you and how you present yourself privately in a lot of cases and make a decision based upon whether you belong in this high-ranking school, whether you should get this job. And so we put an edited form of our professional self online. What happens, and Matt Chandler points this out in his sermon, what happens then is someone who's going through depression or who lost their job, you know, they get a tub of ice cream at 10 a.m. in the morning and they go into their bed to watch Netflix all day, and they open up Instagram, and so they're scrolling through our professionalized version of ourselves. And so that just heaps more condemnation on them. It just heaps more bitterness on them. So there's some weird... there's some weird social dynamics that happen in social media because we do want it to, we want to look all, you know, like we're together. We got it together. You can trust me. You can hire me. You can, you know, invite me to your school. And what that does to someone who's suffering, I think we always have to keep an eye on that. But for leaders, I think there's always a pitfall, and that is that you can share things way too easy. That may not be helpful, that may cause a debate among your friends, that may undermine your authority as a Bible teacher. And I've seen that happen too. Whether it's, you know, most recently like a pro-Trump or an anti-Trump kind of content, like where you jump into politics and maybe you don't know where you didn't intend to incite something, but you can do it really quickly. So you have to be extra careful because of the ease of how quickly you can share things with your people, and they might misread it or not know your intention with it. So there's a lot of pitfalls too that leaders have to walk. And it's I talk with pastors all the time who say, should I even be on Facebook or not? And that's one of the tension points that they face. It's just way too easy to share something that they'll regret.
So far we've talked about the impact mostly of our phones and social media on us as teachers. Before I let you go, let's talk a little bit about how we as teachers need to take into account the effect of social media and technology on the hearts and minds, attention spans, expectations of those we're teaching.
That's a great question. I mean, when you mentioned, it was very kind of you to mention that there's a lot of sentences in the book that stand out to you. When I hear that, I think that's Twitter training me to write that way. So Twitter is like a writing school in the sense that it has to be compact. It has to make sense. It has to be separated from a context and make sense. And it has to be punchy. It has to be true. It has to be relevant. And so if you can do all that on Twitter, like you're training yourself to be a better writer. You're training yourself to be a better teacher. And so one of the beautiful things is to use social media and to say, hey, does this, you know, we use the phrase, does this preach, you know, but really Twitter is that, like, you can see, like, you're putting together a lesson on Genesis. Like, here's an idea, like, float it and see what happens on social media, see how people respond. And so it allows you to sort of get into the minds of people who are coming at this content fresh, and like you've been in Genesis for a month. And they're just reading this tweet. Like, how, do they respond to it? Like, does it make sense to them? Does it not make sense to them?
But even as you say, do they respond to it? That's where we get hungry. We want to be able to
see it. We want to see the validation. Yeah, right, right. And so you have to deal with that in your heart too. But you can also use social media in a way that says, does this make sense to people? And if it does, maybe you're onto something that you need to continue to develop. So you're always dealing with that. Yes, I may be doing this for selfish purposes, or I'm doing this to truly edify. And you're always guarding your heart in those ways. There's no simple answer unless you just ditch social media altogether. And some people have done that, but that doesn't solve all the issues either. Being on social media, like, can you communicate on social media in a way that makes sense to other people? That's a good way to train yourself to teach then when you get into the classroom and you're starting to make your points.
One of your chapter titles, We Feed on the Produce.
Yes.
And that one hit me as being very significant. I think especially if I were teaching children in this day and age and youth, but really adults too. We watch so much that millions of dollars goes into be produced. And so what do you think, Tony? Can we expect that if we sit in a circle in a living room or stand up in a hall at church, there's nothing on a screen, and we're just opening up this ancient book, sharing with the people what God has shown us in it, seeking to illuminate, apply it. Can we expect something to happen with that in the hearts and minds of these that expect everything to be so produced?
It goes back to Job realizing that this is a supernatural reality, that God has got to move, his spirit has to move, eyes have to be opened by the power of God in order to see glory. But the glory is self-attesting in the Bible itself. So our trust and our hope is not that we have enough produced things around the Bible, enough charts and enough graphs and enough pictures and enough illustrations and enough movie clips and music clips around our sermon to make help it make sense. Our hope is that God will open up eyes to see glory in the text itself. That is our only hope. And so when Jesus says, have you not read, have you not read, have you not read, he repeats that over and over again. What he's saying is, have you not read the text and seen glory? That's ultimately what we want to happen, and that's going to happen because God opens eyes. Now, we can do a lot of things to try to illuminate, try to illustrate. We want to labor hard, and it's going to be harder than ever before. I find it harder than ever before to make biblical points. Just because people don't have, they have a very low threshold for how far their brains can go.
I wonder if this level of abstraction means that we, like I'm thinking about my own teaching. I mean, do I need to go through my teaching and make sure I'm giving their brains a break a little more often than maybe I would have had to do 10 years ago?
I think that's part of it. Yeah, I think that's part of it. Using stories, using illustrations is helpful, allow things to soak in. But part of it, too, is we're coming at people and we're explaining, like, for example, the book of Ephesians and Colossians are two books I like to teach. I enjoy teaching them to even young kids, but to adults as well. And what I see in those books is that Paul has a sustained argument that runs from the beginning, especially in Ephesians, all the way to the end. So when you're talking about marriage, you're talking about church unity, all these things, he's drawing on what he assumes early on, which is cosmic Christology. Christ has defeated the powers and principalities. And even to this day, the powers and principalities have been defeated, and they're constantly being reminded that you lost. The cross beat you. And so then when you get into complementarity in marriage, it's not just husband and wife doing things right in the home. This is Christ proclaiming to the powers and principalities, you lost. Look, husband and wife, they get along. You know, the wife submits, the husband leads sacrificially. You lost. So it's you have to teach all of Ephesians to get that. Church unity, multiple races and genders coming together to worship God in harmony. I mean, that's a beautiful fruit of the gospel. And it's saying, powers and principalities, you lost. Look at this church. And so, like, when you're trying to teach the book of Ephesians and you've got the big, glorious theology at the front end and then you've got the practical stuff at the very end, you've got to continue to remind your people that you're looking at this big, cosmic picture. You're not just looking at marriage. You're not just looking at parenting. You're not just looking at church unity. You're looking at Christ defeating the powers and principalities and saying, you lost. This is proof. And so it takes a lot of work, though, for you to see that. You've got to study the entire book of Ephesians, keep it all in mind, and then hopefully offer it up in a way that makes sense to people so that the heavy lifting goes back on the teacher's shoulders. It is especially hard. I mean, there's just so many things grabbing for our eyes, our attention, and it's all, again, I use the word hyper-palatable, but that's the word. I mean, it's like French fries. French fries for the eyes. I mean, it's something that's so irresistible, and it's being more and more made irresistible. And so we're competing with that.
On Sundays when you go to church, do you read the Bible from your phone or a tablet or from a printed Bible?
They have the text on the screen, and so I tend to just watch the screen on the stage.
Yeah.
So I did bring my Bible for a long time, and then I don't know. I kind of play around with different – I think of myself as like being a guinea pig, so I don't know that I've settled on one way to do it that I would do it. So sometimes I bring my Cambridge Bible, which is super nice. I love the feel of it. It's just a beautiful Bible.
You just want everybody to be impressed with your big Cambridge Bible.
And if you had one too, you would bring it to church. It's beautiful. Sometimes I use my phone. Sometimes I just read the text on the screen that's projected. It's a different encounter with the word in each setting.
Well, one reason I asked the question, because, and you already talked about this a little bit. You said when you want to read something deeply, you print it off rather than just read on a screen. And that you make a point numerous times in the book, this very shallow, we've trained ourselves to read shallowly things that are on a screen. Yeah. And so causes me to think that maybe as much as our people might want to resist it, that we might encourage them if they're regularly coming to a study that we're doing. I mean, we don't want to shame them for using it on their, and I've been so glad sometimes I had it on my phone when I didn't have a Bible with me, but I'm just wondering if as teachers, based on some of what you've said in the book, if our people would get more out of our teaching if they were actually looking at a physical Bible.
Maybe. It depends on the person. The thing that I want to stress is that we need to learn to linger on text. Whether that's digital text or on a printed page, we have to learn to linger. And so I hope the next generation that's coming up has the ability to linger more carefully on a digital text. That's my hope. So I'm not just going to beat the drum and say you have to read on a printed Bible, you have to read, you know, things that you can mark with a pen, because I think there is a generation that could maybe master the art of lingering on digital text. I want to leave that option open. But I think in a good Bible teaching church that preaches exegetically, they are modeling slow reading. Whether you're using a digital text or a printed Bible, it's slow reading. What does this phrase mean? What does this sentence mean? What does this sentence mean? So a good expositional preaching is probably the best, most countercultural model of slow reading that we have. Go to a church and just watch a preacher or a Bible teacher walk through the text phrase by phrase, sentence by sentence, pericope by pericope, slow reading. 30 weeks in Ephesians, 20 weeks in the Psalms, whatever it is, slow reading is modeled in exegetical preaching, whether that's on the printed Bible or electronic.
Well, this conversation has been so helpful, Tony.
This has been fun.
Is it a good time for me to ask if you'd be my Facebook friend?
Absolutely. But you look so insecure when you ask. That's the only thing that
Well,
makes
see,
me a
I don't want to
worried.
Really put myself out there and like send off the request and then maybe never hear from you. So I
you
thought maybe we should
request.
Nail it down
I will.
Right now.
Yes, I agree to be your Facebook friend.
Okay.
Forever.
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 I love that. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Help Me Teach the Bible with Nancy Guthrie, a production of the Gospel Coalition, sponsored by Crossway. Crossway is a not-for-profit publisher of the ESV Bible Christian Books and Tracts, including 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You by our guest today, Tony Reinke. Learn more about Crossway's gospel-centered resources at crossway.org.